This is Doug Cooper for Iona College Conversations, a program brought to you by Iona College in New Rochelle, New York. Well, I continue now my discussion begun last week on this program with Mr. E. Power Biggs, who is generally acknowledged to be the world's greatest organist. And as we talk today, we'll hear excerpts from the legendary recordings made by Mr. Biggs on world-famed organs in many countries. Are you ever asked, Mr. Biggs, to choose an organ that has been your favorite? And do you dare to do that?
Well, I always answer that I could name about 500 of them, but I can't name one.
Well, you've done the albums. I think we mentioned that you did the albums, the great organs of France, of Germany, of Spain. Do all of these countries have organs that are really fabulous?
Yes. Now, let me go back. Yes, I can. I guess I can answer it if you let me tell you of one in each country.
All right.
Well, to go back to Bach's church, Thomas Church in Leipzig, the fabulous thing at the end of the D minor toccata recording, you know where it goes,
That's a fabulous recording.
Well, at that point, the whole church seemed to light up with these echoes, you know, flying around like so many birds. Because Bach's church has a fine echo of about 4 to 5 seconds. It supports the music, you know. Well,
wait a minute. Would you say that the construction people in the 1500s are better than our acoustic men today in some ways, Mr. Biggs?
They seemed to know what they were doing, didn't they?
All this acoustic tile that's so very expensive might be done without.
Oh, absolutely. It's put in, then it's ripped out, or it's covered over. Thing to do is not to have it. In Europe, though, they have very often over the pulpit, they have a cover, a canopy, in these European churches. And that, you know, projects the sound. And the canopy may go down behind the speaker, the minister. And that is a sort of projecting horn. Now, we rarely have that in our churches. So even in these reverberant churches, the preacher can be heard, even if people are listening to him or not.
Well, now I'll go back and pin you down on those specific instruments in the various countries.
Okay. Well, I'd say in England, undoubtedly the organ that Handel played in Great Pakington. And then in France, I would choose Alsace, because there are these two Silbermann organs in Ebersmünster and Mormoutier. And then in Holland, heavens, there's so many organs in Holland that it's hard to say, but very likely the organ at Zwolle. Zwolle, how do you spell it? Z-W-O-L-L-E.
Oh, I do a horrible job on some of these pronunciations.
Oh, that's
I'm a little bit. I'm afraid of this one, but you've mentioned a man by the name of Arp Schnitger. Am I doing terrible injustice to that one?
No, you're doing very well. Arp Schnitger. He was Schnitger. It comes from the German word for cutting, to snip, to cut. Arp Schnitger. He was a carpenter. At least his family were carpenters.
Early 1800s, was it?
Yes. Just before the time of Bach, and overlapping with Bach. He was the great organ builder of North Germany, and there are a lot of instruments of his in Germany, all of which are my favorites. In fact, I did an album called The Golden Age of Organ Building, which is all the organs of Arp Schnitger. Well, let's see, then in Austria, well, it's hard to say in Austria, let's say the organ at Eisenstadt that Haydn played. And then certainly in Spain, the organ at Toledo, terrific, the emperor's organ at Toledo.
Well, that's a fabulous city just to visit.
Absolutely, yes.
The whole city practically has been maintained in that in this El Greco period.
Yes, yes. And these organs are loud and rough and brassy and just like the Spanish sky. And then I think my favorite organ over here has to be the organ in the Busch Reisinger Museum at Harvard.
I understand you have compared some of these great organs to the violin maker Stradivarius. You said that there is excellent in their classification as the Stradivarius violins are classification.
Undoubtedly, yes, undoubtedly. And then, of course, there were other great builders, the Silbermann brothers. Andreas Silbermann built many organs in Alsace, the two I mentioned, Marmoutier and Abersmünster, and then Gottfried Silbermann built organs mostly in Saxony, which now, of course, is part of East Germany, the other section of Germany. I was privileged when we went to record in Leipzig to record also in Freiberg in Saxony, on an organ built in, 1721 by Gottfried Silbermann, which Bach played, and which is a very famous organ. It hasn't been touched since the builder left it. Of course, it's been tuned, but it hasn't been changed in any way. And I recorded you mentioned Gottfried Walther, I recorded his six organ concertos there. Well, the interesting thing is that the keys have become so worn that they're like spoons, you know, they're like big teaspoons. Your finger goes right into the keys, into these hollows. In fact, in the middle of the keyboard, the keys are so worn that you go right through the ivory into the wood below. It makes it very distressing to play at first, but you get sort of used to it. But you feel that you add your abrasive fingers to the fingers of history, really.
Yes.
In playing it. It's a very, very unusual feeling. You feel you're just part of a whole stream of players. Well, the point of all this, I'm telling you, is that the wonderful thing is that in this day of recording, if you have a great truckload of equipment and technicians from Zurich and music directors from New York and good German friends and so on, or French friends or English friends, the wonderful thing is that all this can be brought back and laid in front of people in the form of a round records. I feel a little bit like Frank Buck. You remember the great explorer, the animal explorer. He used to bring them back alive. I bring them back aloud, maybe.
Yes, you do. Mr. Biggs, it's a great honor to be speaking with you today. I want to take our listeners back about 1,300 years now and see if there's anything you can tell me about what I understand was one of the first organs ever made, and it was a water-driven, the water power forced the air through the pipes.
Yes. Well, you have to go still further back. You have to go back to the time of Nero, the Emperor Nero, who used to play...
Not Peter Nero.
No, not... wouldn't it be fun if you could get the Emperor Nero on a record? He used to play the hydraulis, as did many people in those days, before the Christian era.
That was the precursor of the organ.
Yes, but the water didn't go through the pipes.
It forced the air. Drove the air.
Yes, but some people are under the impression the water actually went in the pipes. Of course it didn't. The water actually was just a stabilizing medium for the air pressure. You had to pump in air, but the weight of water stabilized the pressure. It was a sort of safety valve. Anyway, the Emperor Nero used to play such a thing, and he used to play it, you know, at circus events, prize fights, if you like, or gladiatorial events. And perhaps they'd throw a Christian to the lions, you know, and then the emperor would play the voluntary, let's say. There's a story about that. Let's say the Christian was thrown to the lions, and this hungry lion bounded out of his cage, roaring away, and he bounded up to the Christian, and he was just about to eat up the Christian, when the Christian said something in the lion's ear. And the lion became very sort of despondent, and with his tail between his legs, turned and went back into his cage. And the Emperor Nero called up the Christian slave and said, "What did you tell that lion that caused him to forego his dinner?" And the slave said, "Sir, I said to the lion, after dinner there will be speeches."
I thought you were going to say that after dinner he was going to play his organ, and he wasn't very good on it.
Oh, no, they say the emperor was first class as a musician.
Was he really?
Yes,
He took time out from watching the Christians being eaten to do a little practicing.
Absolutely. No, I'm not kidding about all this. The famous German musicologist Willy Apple, who came to Harvard just after the war and wrote the Harvard Dictionary of Music, he wrote a pamphlet on all this, and it's quite serious. Anyway, it would be very nice to know what Nero played, and that hydraulis, the water organ, was the precursor of all the instruments today. Shortly thereafterwards, the control of air pressure by water was taken over by valves and pumps and bellows and so on, reservoirs.
Well, I wanted to go back to that period because it seems that the rise and fall of empires maybe parallels the development of the organ and the changes that took place. Isn't that true?
Well, there were many cases during the first 10 centuries when one king would give another king an organ as a present. None of them survive, but they survive in the history books. And I suppose the organs they gave as a present might compare them to the size of a very grand piano turned upright. In other words, they weren't huge instruments, they were transportable. But all these stories of the famous organ, for example, at Winchester in the year 1000, which could be heard for several miles, so the history book says, all these stories just in the history books. But the wonderful thing is that this organ at Zion can be heard. It can be heard in Timbuktu or East Cupcake, Iowa, or anywhere by phonograph records.
Is the 1660 period, the Fire of London era, is that a changing point in the composition for and the composition of the organ itself? In other words, the music for the organ around 1600 or so started to change, and then after the Fire of London, the instrument itself changed for better or worse.
Well, the Fire of London destroyed a lot of churches and a lot of organs, and then Cromwell and his soldiers destroyed a lot more.
That was a low point, that Cromwell period.
Yes, yes. And yet Cromwell loved music, and he liked the organ. But his soldiers got out of hand, you know, the way people, the soldiers do. So the English continuity of organ building has been rather broken. On the other hand, take Germany. Germany had lots and lots of wonderful organs, but a lot of them got destroyed in the last war. Fortunately, in Holland, the occupation prevented a lot of damage. The occupation was not pleasant, but it prevented a lot of churches and organs being smashed up.
You play so fabulously what is known as a heroic music, music that conveys really the temper of the times, the valor of the people, and the courage, even quietness is one of their
well,
qualities.
Well, that's a wonderful, sweet, heroic music by Telemann.
Yes, he was a prolific fellow.
Oh, he was. which I had the privilege of recording that suite with none less than Armando Gattala, the first trumpeter of the Boston Symphony, and his colleagues. And I'm very fond of that suite. As you say, Telemann depicts 12, I suppose you'd say, virtues, wouldn't you? Bravery, courage, peace, quietness, joy, so on. They're short little snapshots in music.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your background, Mr. Biggs, because you were born in England, and I'm just wondering, in your early years, where you first began to play the organ and get your interest in the instrument.
Well, I was born in England, and I studied, curiously enough, electrical engineering for 3 years. And then, by good luck, I won a scholarship at the Royal Academy of Music for 4 years' study with the great English organist of that time, Dr. G. D. Cunningham. And I had the good luck to study with Sir Henry Wood, who was famous as the founder of the proms, the promenade concerts.
Sir Henry got you really your first tour after you were finished at the Academy.
He was quite instrumental in that, exactly. And so I came over here to give... I came over here sort of by instinct, if you like, to give a number of concerts. And I gave a lot of concerts, small little concerts, through the winter.
Well, this must be around 36 or in
it
that era?
Before that, even. Before yes, that. Just before that. And then I went back, as one has to, and applied for entry, and then I came back to, as it proved, to live, yes. Very fortunately so.
Yes, and then it wasn't long after that that, as we mentioned, the broadcasts began here.
Well, it was 42 that they began. Fortunately, there was this organ at the Dramatic Museum, which proved a very good originating point, sounded well, and we had the use of it. And the whole thing just grew like Topsy, you know.
Well, from your perspective, how did you see the groundswell developing? Was it a slow development?
Well, I don't know what you go by unless you go by fan mail, which from the beginning seemed surprisingly, almost alarmingly large, because I like to take it on myself to answer every letter, if possible, sooner or later, very wow. often much later. But then, of course, records came, and people get interested in records. You see, I think you take something like Bolero for the orchestra, or the Stars and Stripes Forever, or Caruso singing, anything you like, and people, that hits people right away, doesn't it? The mere intensity of it. It connects at once. But if you take something like the Bach D minor or the Bach G minor fugue or anything you like for organ, it doesn't necessarily connect at once. The first time you hear an organ, it may sound just a big blur. And then when you hear organ music on records, if it is well recorded, you play it a number of times. And then you begin to see the logic of it. You see, here comes the theme, the subject. Oh, there it comes again, lower down, so on. In other words, you get the structure of the piece. You don't necessarily enjoy organ music the very first time you hear it, the way you do a lot of other music. So I think records, radio played a great deal, but I think records have played a great deal more. For one thing, radio has sort of dropped out creatively. True, it plays a lot of records, but it just depends on records, you see. But records themselves that people hear at home and they say, well, that's pretty interesting. Oh, I see it. There's the theme. Or here it comes, upside down, so on. Then their interest is piqued and they begin to think about it and they enjoy it.
Were there other men around at that time, the mid-30s, that we should note and mention here?
Oh, certainly there was Carl Weinrich, who was making a lot of records for Westminster, Robert Neuren of Ann Arbor. Weinrich is at Princeton, you know. Robert Neuren at Ann Arbor. There were a lot of people, yes. I'm wrong. There were not a lot, but there were some.
A few others, yeah.
And they were doing excellent work.
We did want to talk, of course, Mr. Biggs, about the Harvard instrument.
The organ that was heard all those years on the air was built by Donald Harrison, G. Donald Harrison of Aeolian Skinner. And it was a rather interesting and lucky occurrence. In 1937, Harrison, who was president of Aeolian Skinner, built this organ experimentally. It was quite a small organ. He had just been to Germany. This was before the war, and he'd gone all over Germany, listened to a lot of historic instruments, and he came back and he wanted to create here a sort of an epitome of what he'd heard. He didn't propose to copy anything, but he wanted to sum it up in his own terms. Well, he built this organ, and it was loaned to the Busch Reisinger, to the Germanic Museum, for 1 year. And then I played concerts, and Marcel Dupré played, and Fritz Heitmann played, various people played. Then it got on the air, as you know, CBS Radio. So it was, the loan was extended indefinitely. It stayed here for until 1958, actually.
And 58 was the year?
The year that the Flenthrop
right.
came, yes. Well, you see, I had been to Europe a number of times in the intervening years and recorded, and I felt we ought to have a tracker action organ, really like the great historic organs of Europe. And so we got the Flenthrop, which was put in 1958, and curiously enough, the broadcasts came to an end in 58, although the Flenthrop was heard for a few weeks or months. But the exposure and the connection between the instrument and the public since then has been much more extensive via records. You know, it's an interesting thing with that record. I switch back to Bach's Church once again. The arrangement CBS had, Columbia Records had with the East German authorities was that we would have our masters from which we make records for the US, South America, Australia, England, Europe, and so on. But the East Germans have their master tapes for which they make records for themselves, for Russia, for Poland, Hungary, for all the rest of the world. So it's very interesting. That record goes all around the world under two flags, so to speak.
Yes.
I've got off the Flenthrop, but the Flenthrop also, with the exchange now that Columbia has with Melodia, whatever it is, the Russian company, the Flenthrop would go all around the world too. You see, Columbia is taking some of their records, and they are taking some of Columbia's records, which I think may well include one of ours.
Mr. E. Power Biggs, if you could go back in time, who would you most like to sit and visit with and talk to? I can guess, but I'm not going to. Let me have you tell me.
Well, you may guess Bach, but I think I'd...
That's certainly who I would have said.
Yes, but I'd first of all like to meet Handel. Handel always wanted to meet Bach and vice versa, so I'd like to meet them both. Let me put it this way. I would certainly like to meet Bach, but how humble one would feel. I mean, what could you say?
Well, they would probably be talking for years about having met E. Power Biggs.
Oh, go on. But if one could meet two people, those are the two people I'd like to meet, Bach and Handel, or Handel and Bach. I don't mind in which order.
What would you ask them? Would you want them to play or talk, or what would you say to them?
Well, yes, of course, that's what you would say. Show me how you meant this piece to go. But then they would say, well, give me an organ that I played. Because you couldn't take them to the First Methodist Church of East Cupcake and sit them down and say, play this. They'd have to have the organs that they played. That, you see, brings up a point that we should make quite clear. The unity of music and instrument. In other words, Bach's music sounds at its finest and its best and its most authentic only on an instrument that he played or of the type he played, because the music and the instrument go together.
That's a pretty stringent requirement for the poor guy who wants to just play a few minutes every day and enjoy the instrument.
Yes. Well, of course, he will enjoy the instrument and he will enjoy the music. But my point is that on records, you can couple the two. You see, you can couple the music and in many cases the actual instrument the composer played, for which he sort of conceived the music. The two fit together hand in glove. Of course, I mean, one has to play the instrument you have, and you enjoy it, you enjoy the music. But records are wonderful in uniting music and the authenticity of the sound, the instrument.
Yes. Mr. Biggs, are you a good prognosticator? What do you see for the instrument? Do you see a maintenance of these, certainly abroad, but how about here in this country for the next few decades?
There's no problem about maintenance. After all, think of these organs built in 1550 that are still going strong today. The Flenthrop organ in the museum has had practically no maintenance except tuning, normal tuning once, twice a year, which is very inexpensive. As far as maintenance goes, it's been nil. A tracker action organ is good for 200 or 300 years, at least, if you keep it in, you know, fairly good condition.
What do your writers ask you today when they send you a note or send you a card?
Well, that's a large question. You get all sorts of letters, some of them saying, I am 17 years old, I am studying, please tell me how I can be a great virtuoso.
Beautiful question.
Yes. Another question comes...
Wait, let's have the answer to that one.
Oh, just practice hard, practice the piano every day and see what happens. Practice the piano every day, that's a very important comment.
Do you think people today have the will that they did? And, you know, you hear the talk today about the people don't have the stamina anymore that they did in the past, and they're not going to put up the study that's required. Is that true?
Oh, they do. There are lots of very good players in the U.S. today. There are lots of very good teachers. All of them, many of them, of course, want to get there in a frightful hurry, but that's normal.
It's everybody does, I guess.
And then, of course, other people write, I am writing a term paper on Swaelinck, or on the organs Swaelinck played in Holland, or the organs Bach played, anything you like. Please send me all you know about the subject, you know. In other words, write my paper for me. Now, I'm not spoofing these letters because people are very, very generous in the letters they send in. It's very informative. You get a letter from the middle of Texas and he proposes the recording of some totally unknown organ work or composer. And as you think of it, you think, that's a very good idea. That really is a field that should be explored. He's been sitting down there in the middle of nowhere thinking about it, and he takes the trouble to write about it. I appreciate all these letters. Believe it or not, I wrote 115 letters between Christmas and New Year's. Let me say that if I met Handel and Bach, I would also want to meet Joseph Rheinberger, who lived a century ago and who wrote these two marvelous concertos for organ.
Well, I just would like to say here, Mr. Biggs, that you're lucky in a way that you're not going to go back and meet these men, because you might live in frustration the rest of your life on the question that you forgot to ask.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mr. Biggs, it's been just a delight and very, very informative speaking with you today. Thank you so much for letting me come and visit with you.
Thank you indeed for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you.